to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for the day, Greta Anderson. Friday marked one of the milestones in the Iowa legislative session, the second funnel, at which point a policy bill must be passed out of committee of both legislative chambers if it is to continue on. Budget bills are taken up after that time. This deadline produced a flurry of legislation. In this show, we're going to hear about how Ames Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel spent her last week. Also, we'll hear from an Ames activist who is focused on improving Iowa's provisions for medical marijuana. But first, it's Monday, so let's hear what Mother Nature has in store for us in the upcoming week.
Well, the rain we had this past weekend sort of greened things up. We're talking weather here with ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor, and we're into the month of April here, so maybe spring is here to stay, Elwin.
With April showers, spring is here, the grass is getting greener in most places, and yes, precipitation is getting more common. In fact, the flow of air on a regular basis from the Gulf of Mexico looks like it has started and will be getting stronger. That is Bermuda high pressure, giving some symbols to us and some examples of going into place. I looked at the map on that. Yes, it is. And storms forming down around Dallas, Texas, bringing moisture up. We haven't seen the rest of all of it for this week just yet. It will be a little bit cooler during the middle of the week at night, back down into the 30s. But by the time we get to the end of the week, the temperatures will be up a little bit more pleasant again, both day and night, and it will feel like spring. The 6 to 10 day outlook from the National Weather Service tells us to anticipate that we will be warmer than usual right through the 12th of the month, and then a little bit of normal precipitation chance as well, and then normal temperatures all the way out beyond that to the 16th, still slightly above normal chances for precipitation. So things not looking bad. People talking about the El Nino that's going on in South America. It seems to be weakening. It doesn't look like we'll have El Nino effects up here, but don't expect a drought either, at least as things stand now. Wishing you the very best weather. Doesn't look really bad, but as soon as we get past the next couple of days and back to warm temperatures.
And ISU Extension climatologist Dr. Elwin Taylor joining us. I'm Vaughn Kettleson.
And this is Local Talk. Last week, Facebook friends and followers of Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel learned of an abortion bill that took a very sudden, hard right turn when it got to the House Human Resources Committee, where Beth is a ranking member. In other words, the highest-ranking Democrat in a Republican-led committee. Beth and others used social media last week to expose the bill's extreme, some may say archaic, provisions. Here's her story.
It is a tangled web, but the Senate passed a 20-week ban on abortions. So a 20-week ban means that a woman who has reached 20 weeks, she would no longer be able to have an abortion. That, on the surface, sounds very reasonable because most women know they're pregnant by 20 weeks. There's a lot of development that's happened to the fetus by 20 weeks. And, of course, we want to be very respectful of that. Well, I can give you two examples of how that is a problem. First of all, there's a young woman who testified before us on how her fetus was found to be incompatible with life at 21 weeks. And she was given a week to get more testing, to make a decision about it. And she's from Waukee, and her choice was to terminate the pregnancy. Even though there was a heartbeat, this fetus had no room to grow lungs and was never going to grow lungs. So she terminated that pregnancy, and she made a strong plea for us to allow other women to be allowed to make that decision on their own with their families, their faith, and their physicians. That bill passed out of the Senate. It was now up for debate in the House. And a half an hour before we went into that committee meeting for debate, I was handed an amendment that struck everything from the enacting clause. So this was a whole new bill. And this bill essentially eliminated all abortions statewide. It's called a 6-week ban. And so some women don't even know they're pregnant at 6 weeks. And it would have not allowed an abortion from actually 5.5 to 6 weeks, someplace in there, any abortions. There was a slight exception for the life of the mother and the health of the mother, but they were very limited and hard to define exceptions. In that bill also was, or it's an amendment at this point, in that amendment was what's called the cause of action. And under that cause of action, a parent of an adult unmarried woman or the spouse of a married woman had the right to stop that woman from seeking an abortion. There were many, many HIPAA violations, so that would be your privacy. And it included a 72-hour waiting period for an abortion. And the woman would be required to have an ultrasound 72 hours previous to the abortion. Ultrasounds are done commonly previous to an abortion, but this required it in 72 hours in advance, which gave family members, I guess, time to discover and take it to court. It was a bill that took us back to the 19th century, no doubt. I went to the chair of the committee. His name is Representative Joel Fry. And I said that Democrats would stay here all night, but we weren't going to debate this bill that night until we had time to, you know, read it fully and be able to absorb and develop our arguments, develop possible amendments, and really come to an understanding of what the bill meant. Since it did not get a subcommittee hearing, we really felt that the public needed to know. So we all went up on our social media. We called a press conference and made sure that this information through the media, through social media, got out to our constituents so they could let their representatives know how they felt. By the next day, committee meeting started at 3 o'clock. We were told that they had another amendment, and that went back to the 20-week ban.
So the bill started as a 20-week ban. Then it became a bill that was constituted by basically an amendment because the whole 20-week ban had been struck. And they tried something that was extreme, including both a 6-week ban and this parental rights over a woman's body and spousal rights. And then they realized that there was no go for that.
I think you have to give credit to the media, to social media, and to all the people who spoke out against it. I think, you know, and I do not want to take away from the fact that a 20-week ban puts many women's lives at danger, and it does not allow them to say, to make a choice when their pregnancy has gone terribly wrong. You know, I can give you another example, which I think is really important. Nebraska 6 years ago passed a 20-week ban, and it was signed by their governor. A woman 6 weeks later was 21 weeks pregnant, and her water broke. And if you have a healthy pregnancy and you are at term and your water breaks, your doctor, at least this happened to me 20 years ago, tells you to come to the hospital right away because you are at risk of getting a major infection, and they guarantee that this child will be delivered within 24 hours. And, you know, if it's not going to come out naturally, they will do a C-section because you are at such a high risk of infection due to your water breaking. But this woman, because she was not immediately, her life wasn't immediately at risk, was sent home to wait until either her life was at risk or she went into a natural labor. Typically, what a doctor would do would induce labor for this woman, and because there was no hope for her fetus. There was no hope. And her life was at risk, but not at immediate risk. Those are the types of risks we're putting women at by passing this bill. I talked to obstetricians from all over the state this past week. We had one on the phone right before we went into committee who was in tears begging us not to pass this bill, and she is a Republican. She said, we work so hard to provide good health care for women and their families, but don't tie our hands. So the 20-week ban, although it sounds like a much better bill, it's not. it puts women's lives at risk, and we have no business doing that.
It's really about emergency medical services and, like gynecologists said, tying the hands of people who might provide that emergency medical service.
Exactly.
It's 'cause a woman, if it was a case of an abortion, you know, you can always go across state lines and find a state where it's not illegal. But if you are in an emergency situation,
it's very difficult. And even if you're going to go across state lines, we have to remember that there are a lot of people who can't afford. You know, they don't have transportation. They don't have the resources. And we need to respect Iowa women and allow them to have access to full reproductive health care in Iowa.
So this is a bill that it appears will proceed on?
Yes. We had many questions for the floor manager. I stepped out of the room, but I have seen the video. The floor manager was asked by one of our members, Representative Forbes from Urbandale. He is a pharmacist, and his daughter is 20 weeks pregnant and going in for a test next week to stage the size of her fetus and where she is in her pregnancy, commonly done with all healthy pregnancies. And he asked the floor manager, Representative Lundgren, if his daughter discovered, tragically, that there was no heartbeat next week, would she be required to carry this child to term? Representative Lundgren said this is not a bill about protecting women. It's a bill about protecting unborn children, and said, yes, she would have to carry that child to term. We did read the bill. A woman would be allowed to terminate a pregnancy where the unborn child has no heartbeat.
But if it has, if the unborn child has some kind of fatal flaw that will cause it to...
You would not be able to. And the interesting thing about Representative Lundgren's comments were that how she didn't really understand the bill. We only had 2.5 to 3 hours of studying the bill. But that's one of the first things you look for. So because you cannot carry a dead fetus, the conditions that could lead to death or loss of reproductive health, infertility, many different really tragic things. And so it is stunning that anybody would have brought a bill that they thought said that forward, just so unethical.
Do we have a name for this bill?
It is Senate File 471. It is the 20-week ban on abortions. I have requested some amendments.
What are those amendments?
Well, first of all, I would ask for exemptions for rape, incest, health and life of the mother, and fetal anomaly. So I would ask for 5 exceptions. That's one amendment. I'm also concerned, you know, sometimes, I know these are really rare, but sometimes a doctor can do surgery or some kind of treatment on a fetus before it's born to allow it either a better life or life itself. And I think parents deserve the right to pursue those kinds of medical interventions, but I think it puts a doctor at risk not being allowed to make that decision. I think that with a 20-week ban, a doctor may not make that recommendation because of the risk it would put him at in civil court. So I have an amendment to allow the physician to make a recommendation to save the life of the fetus if he or she can using medical intervention that's been approved. And I have a 3rd amendment, one that would just say we will leave it up to the doctor in his best medical judgment to decide what is in the best interest of the mother and the fetus.
Here on Local Talk, we've also been following the Planned Parenthood defunding bill, Senate File 2, which would refuse $3 million in federal Medicaid money for preventative reproductive health care in exchange for the state's privilege of denying funds to clinics performing abortion. This bill was not passed through the House Human Services Committee, the committee again on which Beth Wessel-Crichel is ranking member. Despite the arrival of the funnel last week, that does not mean that these provisions are dead. As Representative Wessel-Crichel explains, this provision is likely to become a budget item in the upcoming weeks. Here's Beth describing some of that bill's intricacies and its implications.
So in the Iowa House, we did not take up that bill. And it's called the Defund Planned Parenthood Bill, but in actuality, there is no line item in the state budget that funds Planned Parenthood. This is a Medicaid waiver, which the federal government funds 10 to 1, which is solely for family planning. And what it does is provides for cancer detection, it provides for contraception, and for STD detection and treatment. That's all the family planning waiver does. It can go to anybody who is a Medicaid provider, so it does not simply go to Planned Parenthood. It goes to any medical clinic that provides those three services. We get about $3 million from the federal government for that. And so what the bill does is says, we don't want your $3 million. We're not going to connect this to Medicaid, that we are going to fund it with our own $3 million, and it can't go to anyone who provides an abortion. There are a lot of complications with the bill, because more clinics than you think might provide abortions, particularly in emergency situations. And so that bill was not brought up. I've been working against this issue for quite a few years. And every year that we have done it in the House, it has been on the Health and Human Services budget appropriations. So I suspect that it will be on that budget bill again this year.
Okay. And so does that mean that it's quite likely this thing will come to pass?
We would have to pass Health and Human Services budget sub exactly the same way in the House and the Senate, which will likely include this language. And it's a priority for the governor, a priority for the Senate because they passed it out, and the House has done it in the past. I can't imagine that we won't take it up on the Health and Human Services budget sub. And that would be a priority for the House Republicans.
And this is taking away $3 million of federal funding. It's making it more difficult for people to get these services. What are their answers to those problems when people bring them up?
There was a subcommittee on this issue in the House, and at that time, a group passed out a list of 250-some clinics in rural Iowa that would be able to provide some of those services. It's interestingly, they asked them if they provided cancer screenings. They asked them if they provided STD screenings and treatment. And then they asked them if they provided contraception. Some of those clinics actually answered that they provide contraception counseling, but not actually contraception. These were all rural clinics. Also interesting is that Unity Point had about 20 of the clinics on that list. And Unity Point, one of their OBGYNs testified at that subcommittee that she does provide emergency abortions through Unity Point and that she refers women to places where they can get abortions. So that would eliminate, in the language of the bill, all those Unity Point clinics. And I suspect there are other clinics that would be eliminated also.
But these clinics at this moment are not prohibited from receiving Medicaid funding for those services, right?
Right. Mostly what the family planning piece of Medicaid waiver does is prevention. Their goal is to prevent unintended pregnancies. So nobody who provides Medicaid would be denied the opportunity to provide family planning waiver Medicaid services.
It's confusing, really.
It is confusing.
Because there's been talks of a kind of a replacement system.
Correct.
For taking care of these issues, and yet those providers have all along been welcome to be part of the Medicaid system.
Absolutely. They can, and some of them are probably. The list that we were given were all rural clinics. A lot of rural Iowans who are facing some of these really private issues do come into an urban setting to get those services because of wanting to remain anonymous. And in rural Iowa, that's sometimes very difficult. So we see a lot of rural Iowans in the urban settings. What I found was there was not a single urban clinic listed on the list that we were given. And I am concerned that most of those clinics would denied access to funding for the family planning waiver due to the fact that they probably do provide abortions particularly in emergency situations.
And it's also a question of whether they speak of abortions as well. Is that
there? If that could be. Also, I called a couple of larger clinics just to say, do you prohibit abortions being performed in your clinic? And they were a couple of urban clinics. And they said it's up to the individual provider. So that if a doctor chooses to provide an abortion, that doctor has made that decision. The clinic doesn't ban them. They leave it up to the individual
doctor. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the replacement system that has been proposed by the Republicans is, first of all, going to cost us an extra $3 million, but also might be limited to rural areas, and women in the urban context might not have a place to get these preventative services.
You know, my impression is that the urban areas might more likely be willing to provide some limited abortions, and therefore they would be denied access to the family planning waiver.
Well, I guess you have another week ahead of you.
I think we have at least a couple of weeks. So getting lots of sleep this weekend, gearing up for some more fights.
Once again, Representative Beth Wassell-Crichel, Iowa District 45. You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. When we return, we explore another complicated legislative issue in Iowa, medical marijuana.
Legalize it. Don't criticize it. I will advertise it. Some call it Tampi. Some call it the weed. Some call it marijuana.
Yeah.
Some of them call it ganja.
Ames resident James Karimi has spent the last 9 years of his life advocating for legalization of medical marijuana. It all started when he was a freshman at Iowa State, suffering from major depression.
I couldn't focus on my classes. I had D's and F's in my classes, and I wouldn't come out of my dorm room because I was trying to study and come up with some way to pass my classes. My roommate actually got annoyed with me one day and came home and said, why don't you at least go smoke some pot or something so at least those losers get out of their dorm room. I did it, and I came back, and all of a sudden my staring at the same piece of paper over and over, it finally clicked, and I was able to focus. And in a month, I brought my grades up from D's to A's. So I actually spent my finals in jail and still passed my classes. My grades were so good.
The reason why Jason was arrested and put into jail, you guessed it, possession of marijuana.
I then, through sheer coincidence, found myself at a medical cannabis forum, very skeptical, watching patients speak. And by the end of it, I was bawling my eyes out and got up to speak. And I said, I just have to do something to help and understand this issue. So I spent a year sitting down, reading every spare moment of my time, trying to research, saying either this is good for people or this is bad, and I want the truth. And after a year of doing research, I said, not only is this good, but this is borderline miraculous. And once everyone else learns about this, they're going to get on board with this. This is a value issue. This is a Christian value issue. And it's simply a matter of fear that makes people think that there's something inherently wrong with it.
Beginning in 2009 with the organization Iowa Patients for Medical Marijuana, Karimi began to lobby the Iowa legislature about the importance of medical marijuana. His efforts, he says, were hindered by some of the complications that arose in other states where medical marijuana had become legal. Namely, some of the marijuana growers and distributors were using this opportunity to profit excessively. Then during the 2014 legislative session in Iowa, a session dominated by Republicans, although the Iowa Senate remained in Democratic control, lawmakers in Iowa became interested in medical marijuana for a very small subset of the population with epilepsy.
We, in spite of quite a bit of odds stacked against us, we were able to educate key legislators who found compassion for sick patients throughout Iowa. And they saw that this wasn't some kind of scam or some kind of hoax. And once they saw the data and the science and everything behind it, they became individually convinced that, in their opinion, as non-medical professionals, they should get out of the way of the actual medical professionals. They excluded every other illness that anyone else had talked about. They wanted to focus just on the epileptic thing. What had happened was the year prior to this was there's a CNN documentary came out. So it was called Weed by Dr. Sanjay Gupta. And when that happened, all the epilepsy mothers around the country came out in force.
But in Karimi's view, this limitation to epilepsy is the least of the problems with Iowa's medical marijuana law, which is now in effect. The problem, as many of our listeners will know, is that patients who can legitimately use medical marijuana cannot legitimately buy or grow marijuana in Iowa. Distribution is also illegal.
So Iowa's cannabis bill was said to be the worst bill in the country. To this day, none of the national cannabis reform organizations recognize Iowa as having any legitimate medical program because our legislators actually encouraged sick, vulnerable Iowans to violate federal law and become interstate drug smugglers. They actually wanted people to go to Colorado, and Colorado doesn't allow medical sales for out-of-state patients. The only state in the country that does is Oregon. But for whatever reason, our lawmakers were telling people to go to Colorado and that would somehow be legal, which is incorrect.
They'd have to pass through Nebraska.
Yep.
Which doesn't allow marijuana for any purpose.
Well, it's decriminalized, but yeah, they're not happy about this supposed increase in trafficking across their state. So yeah, they've tried to crack down on that. They even sued the state of Colorado. They ended up losing, but Nebraska actually tried to sue the state of Colorado by claiming it was a violation of federal law and it was interfering with their ability to police their own state.
And then once the patient with the medical marijuana gets to the border of Iowa, are they allowed to be driving in Iowa with that in their possession?
Yes. If at that point they were pulled over, they would then show their medical card to the officer. He would run it with the database that the state of Iowa has, and my understanding is they would then be free to go.
But if it were somebody acting on behalf of that individual going to Colorado to get the marijuana or the oil?
I'm not a lawyer, so I don't want to give any kind of inappropriate advice.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure how that would work.
Okay. Several things have changed since then. The year after the Iowa law went into effect, Minnesota opened itself to medical marijuana use for not only epilepsy patients, but also those with multiple sclerosis and other unrelieved pain. Also, Karimi believes that the climate surrounding marijuana has continued to become more open.
Now that education has happened, especially post-2014, we've seen that the largest growing demographic of people who use this plant is actually the elderly, and that the teen use in the states where it has been legalized has gone down dramatically. Because it's no longer a cool factor, it's no longer taboo, it's no longer rebellious, now it's just seen as something grandma gets out of her medicine cabinet and uses to make her feel better before she goes to sleep.
Still, the 2014 Iowa law has a fatal flaw.
The problem with this bill this year is that it's expiring on July 1st. So either we pass something new or all these patients get left with absolutely no protection. At least right now there is some halfway protection, even if they can't get the actual plant in state and have to violate federal law to access it. There is still that protection from the state, at least recognizing it has medical utility. So if we don't get through this session without passing something, Iowa patients are going to be left out to dry.
No bills were taken up this legislative session concerning medical marijuana. However, Iowa Patients for Medical Marijuana Director Jason Karimi has hopes, based on rumors from Republican Iowa House Speaker Linda Upmeyer, that some kind of deal with Minnesota might be made.
A fantastic idea from our Republican House speakers come out about a week and a half ago. It's left a lot of questions, but it's an excellent idea. Her idea is to get cannabis from Minnesota. What happens is, again, she got educated. Like myself, she used to be against this issue. And once doing research, she's gotten excited about it. So now she's found that this is legitimate. People need this, and this is real. So how do we get it to people is the next obvious question. Her concern is it's going to take a full 2 years for the legislature to be able to get a program that brings access to Iowans. So in that 2 years, people are dying. They're sick. It's already been 3 years of this happening. And her idea to remedy that is to send Iowans to Minnesota. To that end, she claims that last Thursday, week before this week's Thursday, she spent an entire day in Minnesota talking to one of their two state licensed growers. And we don't know who that is. There's Leafline Labs and Minnesota Medical Solutions, LLC. One of those two she's been talking to, and we're trying to figure out who that is. So I've contacted both of them and left voicemails and emails and hope to hear back from them by this week. On top of that, I contacted Governor Dayton's office. He called me back and said to contact their House Speaker, and that's where we're at currently as far as trying to find out who all is involved in these discussions.
Whether or not this deal with Minnesota gets made, Jason's concerned about the mismatch between federal and state law. I talked about this with him at length. At the risk of getting too deep into the weeds on that topic, I'm going to share that conversation with you now.
In the Iowa Code, Section 124.203, there's three requirements for the classification of any substance in a Schedule I substance. It must have no accepted medical use in the United States. That's the full phrase. So no accepted medical use in the United States. Prior to 1996, no state had accepted medical use of cannabis. In 1996, California accepted the medical use of cannabis. At that point in time, Schedule I classification was null.
Okay. It should have been null.
Should have been nullified. And the activists that wrote that bill in 1996 said they were going to take care of that. And the reason they didn't was because there was a federal highway funding issue. They didn't want to lose money from the federal government. They were afraid that they would have funding cut if they pushed this issue politically. So they just kind of said somebody else will take care of it. Eventually, now it's 2 decades later and it's still a problem.
It's still a problem because every state that now has medical marijuana still has not removed marijuana from Schedule I classification.
Yes. And like I said, Oregon did remove it from Schedule I, but they did it inappropriately. So if you're going to remove it, you have to go through the process. And not every state has this process. The way this was originally set up was a uniform federal Controlled Substances Act. The states then applied and adapted that act to their own state with some variations. Iowa, not to get too complicated, but Iowa is the only state in the country that has it classified in both Schedule I and Schedule II. No other state has that situation. So on the books, we have an issue just right there where it can confuse people. It actually confused Kevin McCarthy back in 2011 when we were lobbying at that point. He said, it looks like we already have the ability to pass a medical bill. It's not the legislators' problems anymore. So the confusion over this has been causing issues. But let's see, if you go to like Gonzalez versus Oregon is the main case from 2006 that started our whole strategy in Iowa. And that has to deal with an assisted suicide law where the federal government tried to override a state medical program. Okay. So the relevance to this state medical program is in that case, the court not only said the federal government cannot do that, but the states, quote, explicitly, this Controlled Substances Act explicitly contemplates a role for the states in regulating controlled substances. So your duty is not absolved. The federal government, you're not waiting on the federal government to do something. You must, as a state, lead the federal government. And that's what Obama, during his tenure as president, repeatedly told people. So it was not on the federal government to solve this. The prerogative is on the states.
As far as the classification as Schedule I, Schedule II.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting stuff, Jason.
Yeah.
And we'll see what happens to this and whether Iowa can lead the way toward a clarification for the rest of the states on the way to do this.
Well, we're doing it.
Jason Karimi of Ames, Director of Iowa Patients for Medical Marijuana. This is Local Talk. I'm Greta Anderson.
So you got to legalize it. Don't criticize it. Legalize it, yeah, yeah, and I will advertise it. Keep on telling them, legalize it.
next week brought a special guest to Drake University in Des Moines. It was Bassem Youssef, an Egyptian physician who quit his profession to become a full-time comedian once his first YouTube video went viral. This was immediately after the Arab Spring Revolution in Egypt in 2011, during which the dictator Mubarak was deposed.
So the first video that we posted was on the 8th of March, 2011. That was after Mubarak steps down. So we didn't think that there would be danger. I mean, of course, I could say, like, I was doing the videos in the middle of the revolution, but, like, you know, the records are there. You cannot lie. You cannot make up this stuff. I wish, but... So this was a project that was thought between me and my friends that, at that time, there were hardly any original Arabic YouTube content. And we were thinking about this for a year, but we didn't think that this would be political satire thing, because under Mubarak it was absolutely impossible. So when the revolution happened, there was an opening. I always dreamt of having something that would be like Jon Stewart, The Daily Show. So we did it. At that time, I didn't know what to expect. I thought I would have 10,000 views, and I ended up having 5 million in a few weeks. Of course, 5 million now, like, your cat makes more than 5 million. But at that time, 5 million on YouTube in Egypt was a huge deal. I mean, when that happened, at that moment, I was just waiting for my papers to come from Cleveland, because I was accepted to a fellowship in Cleveland. So I was waiting for an H-1B visa, something that you will not see again. And, it's going to be relics, H-1B visa. And I was killing time. So I didn't really think that this would go anywhere. I didn't think it would be... It was... for me, we were playing. And it turned serious after a couple of weeks.
Bassem Youssef became a sensation in Egypt, and his political satire show, modeled on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, ran for 3 years during a tumultuous era in Egypt until he was taken off the air by political authorities. At Drake University last week, he was introduced by a young Egyptian exile, Issam Bure, who has actually been on Local Talk before, talking about his experiences in the Arab Spring Revolution. Issam appreciated Bassem's public support when he and others from his American-affiliated NGO back in Egypt were jailed by the Egyptian government. He introduced Bassem by thanking him for that support, and I'll cue the audio with Bassem's response.
And I remember when I was having my show, against the will and the desire of my team, I went ahead and I wanted to go and said, we have to speak about those people. And this was a risk, because now the public opinion was all turning against the United States and their NGOs. And of course, everybody comes from the United States is a traitor, although we receive $1.3 billion of military aid from the same country that we are that conspires against us. Then now we are very happy to visit. It's And in my book, I say, like, you guys, if you are trying to analyze our relationship with America, you don't need a political scientist, you need a therapist. And, yeah, it's in my book. It's outside, you can buy it. As you can see, I'm shamelessly promoting myself like any American. And, so I'm learning my lessons here. Quarters. And one of the most common conspiracies about those, institutes that they were promoting a conspiracy to divide Egypt into 5 different states, to fragment it. And that was based on a map that was right there in the lobby, and these were basically the electoral regions. So it's like going in, it's like, oh, America, we're like, somebody is trying to divide it to 50. It's like, it's 50 states. So, and this was huge. And, this was a propaganda stunt. And this is what authoritarian regimes do. They want to create an enemy, and to rile people behind, to fight this enemy. And at the same time, behind closed doors, they are in bed with that enemy. They are receiving aid, they are having security measures, which is quite interesting and disappointing at the same time. And it is a common narrative. It's a common practice that we've seen with many authoritarian regimes, and I guess you guys are starting to see some of this. But the difference is that I think after 50 years of having the Soviet Union as the main enemy, after the Soviet Union is gone, so you didn't know what to do with yourselves. You had all of these military, you don't know what to do with it. You had like Hollywood movies that like they don't have an enemy anymore. So we Arabs, we stepped in. So America, you're welcome. We are happy to create more jobs. So thank you. You're welcome, and I'm happy to be here. And that was my introduction. Yes.
Thank you. So. Building on your point, Bassem, now every time I open the TV, I feel like home. You know, I'm quoting you here. Every time you listen to the president talking about the fake news or media or the enemies, I feel like these back in the days when our presidents used to do the same word, like the great Gaddafi, dictator of Libya, and the others. So someone like you is working on media, and you've suffered a lot during your work in media. So how do you see this right now?
Well, I think it's unfair to compare what's happening now in America with what's happening in the Middle East. I mean, I think it's like a little bit of a long shot. We do that jokingly, but I think you have a lot to learn about dictatorship first. So you're not there yet. You need to work hard to get to be a dictator. You cannot just earn a dictatorship just because you lost one election. So you can't. We worked hard for 60 years to have something like this, and you can't just like come along and take this away from us. So no, you still have a lot to learn. You're still far behind. That's the only field that we can claim ahead of you. You can have your technology, you can have your military, you can have your everything, but dictatorship, it's ours. And the thing is, like, you're trying to follow suit. So it seems that Middle East, after being for centuries the cradle of civilization, we're also going to be the cradle of the end of civilization.
That is Bassem Youssef, an Egyptian comedian who is living in the United States now in exile. Youssef had a show modeled on Jon Stewart's The Daily Show, pointing out the absurdities in his country's government. He was asked by an audience member whether he was ever afraid of being taken off the air or worse. Here is his response.
So the fact that how we continue under pressure, there was no choice, basically. We had one thing in mind. Come Friday, we have to have a show. So I wasn't really afraid of being persecuted. I was afraid of failing or giving a bad show. Because if you have your show stopped, your show stops. But if you fail, that means that you had a bad show that had stopped and nobody would care about it. So we were more concerned about giving a good show 100% of the time. There was a lot of pressure, and we were working under this pressure, but comes writing time, the door closes, we sit down, and we write the best jokes as much as we can, we do the best research as much as we can, and we would do, and at a certain point, we knew that our days are numbered.
Bassem Youssef answered a couple of questions about the role of satire and entertainment in a rapidly changing political world.
So here's the thing about satire. I think we are too fascinated about satire. I mean, satire is great and everything, but satire will not do anything by itself. Satire, its only role is to bring more people to the table to be more engaged and to give a damn about what's happening. I mean, if people would be... many people not be encouraged to follow the very tedious discussions about the budget or the role of the environmental protection agencies or the recent cuts of the government, but satire makes it easier for them to follow. Now, the next step is not in the hand of the satirist. The satirist, the effect of the satirist or the role of the satirist stops at the edge of the theater, at the edge of your television. If the people didn't go out and vote and make a difference, it will not mean anything. You know, if you just use satire about like laughing at the end of the night and just like having using this as a catharsis, and when comes election time, you don't go and vote, it doesn't matter. It happened 2004 with George W. Bush like making America involving in two wars, and yet Kerry lost because Democrats didn't go out and vote. And I would say, forget about changing people's mind. Those Trump supporters will not change their mind. Focus on your people going up to put on the vote and not being lazy and staying at home. And we had the same thing in Egypt. People were laughing all of the time. Yes, that's so good. And when it came the moment of truth, they thought that just laughing at the authority is enough. No, you change politics in the polling stations, not sitting in front of television laughing at comedians. I think the big mistake that we had with the Arab Spring, that people thought of the Arab Spring of a very nice social media event that will end by the end of the season, and people will tweet and share and like. Revolutions don't work this way. If you had if Twitter and Facebook was around when the French revolutions were around, they would be very disappointed. Even the American Revolution wasn't fulfilled overnight. You had to go through a lot of struggle, a lot of pain, a lot of blood, in order not just to have your revolution against Britain, but also fighting within yourself. And I'm not talking even about the Civil War. I'm talking like way before, even after the Declaration of Independence occurred. You had fights until you had the Constitution written. So I think I always say that the revolution is not an event. It's a process. It's a very long process. It's a generational issue. You have to get rid of 60 years of deep state with all of these convoluted connections and layers of power. So it started, and I think the Middle East will not be the same after 2011. It might not be ugly. It might not be beautiful. It would be ugly. It would be might be even disastrous. But this is the course of history. Yeah.
That was Bassem Youssef, an Egyptian comedian in exile, who was at Drake University last week to raise interest in his book, Revolution for Dummies, Laughing Through the Arab Spring. We are going to close out the show today with a song by Rockets of Desire. This Ames band will be performing at KHOI's Fun Drive kickoff party this coming Sunday, and you won't want to miss them. This party runs from 4 to 8 and includes dessert refreshments. Here's Ames Band Rockets of Desire from their self-titled album Rockets of Desire with their self-titled song Rockets of Desire.
Spark, send up a rocket, ignite the dark, send up a rocket, ignite the dark, whispering sound of a sputtering fuse, might as well try it, you've got nothing to lose, rockets of desire, send them out, with caress or a whisper or a roaring shout. Thank you.
sex in the earthly lungs. Send rockets of desire with the pheromones. Rockets of desire with the pheromones. Christian God thought the devil had won. Send a rocket of desire, his only son. Rocket of desire, his only son. Whispering sound of a sputtery fuse. Might as well try it, you've got nothing to lose. Rockets of desire, send them up. With caress or a whisper or a roaring shout.
Listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I've been your host for the day, Greta Anderson. We started the show with House District 45 Representative Beth Wessel-Crichel telling us about some abortion legislation that cropped up last week in the Human Resources Committee of the House. This legislation would have made the ban on abortion start at 5.5 weeks and would have given parents of unmarried adult women the right to stop them from having an abortion. Due to public outrage, that draft of the bill was scrapped, but the legislature is likely to pass a 20-week ban in its place. Beth also caught us up on the legislation that would defund Iowa's preventative reproductive health care system. We also spoke with Jason Karimi, the director of Iowa Patients for Medical Marijuana, who is hoping that some deal to maintain Iowa's modest provisions will appear late in this legislative session, and possibly a deal with Minnesota to allow Iowa patients to obtain marijuana from Minnesota. Finally, we took a trip down to Des Moines to hear the John Stewart of Egypt, Bassem Youssef, address an audience at Drake University. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoyfm.org. That's khoyfm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. And you can like us on Facebook and get updates on all of our show postings in your news feed. Thanks to webmaster Ron Carson for making that possible. Local Talk was engineered by myself, Greta Anderson. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard was Legalize It by Peter Tosh and Rockets of Desire by Rockets of Desire. And don't forget, they will be playing this Sunday evening at an open house party at KHOY that will kick off our fun drive. It's from 4 to 8 on Sunday. I expect Rockets of Desire will be occupying the latter half of that time period. Please come by and say hi to us and listen to the music and enjoy some desserts that we will be serving. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio. Thank you.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
Support for KHOI comes from ISU Theater, presenting Little Women, the musical, following four sisters as they grow from childhood to adulthood. March 31st through April 9th at Fisher Theater in Ames. Tickets and more information can be found at theater.iastate.edu.